KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Regarding the ongoing situation in Iran, I have a message directly from the president, and I quote, "Based on the fact that there's a substantial chance of negotiations that may or may not take place with Iran in the near future, I will make my decision whether or not to go within the next 2 weeks."
President Trump's yet to decide whether the United States will bomb Iran. The threat comes as the death toll continues to rise. President Trump was elected in part on the promise not to pursue new wars in the Middle East. Then the Supreme Court upholds a ban on health care for transgender youth.
The recent Supreme Court decision in United States versus Scrimeti is a blow to efforts to fight back against bans on medical care for transgender adolescents, but the court's decision leaves open many possibilities for both legal and other advocacy strategies to continue to fight for trans justice.
We'll be joined in New York by ACLU attorney Chase Strangio. He's the first openly trans attorney to argue a case before the Supreme Court. Then to Australia. We'll speak with a Columbia University graduate who was denied entry back into the United States because of his writing about pro-Palestine protests on campus.
Well, the first thing that happened when I landed at LAX was I was called by name over the loudspeaker and taken directly into secondary processing where my phone was taken from me. And I was interrogated about my views on Israel and Gaza for over half an hour.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians have taken to the streets to protest Israel's escalating attacks and to reject U.S. intervention. This comes as Iran's foreign minister is meeting with counterparts from France, Germany, and the United Kingdom in Geneva as the conflict between Iran and Israel stretches into its second week following Israel's unprovoked initial attack on June 12th. The White House said Thursday President Trump will decide within 2 weeks whether the U.S. will strike Iran. The White House refused to say whether Trump would bypass congressional authorization for any such strikes as required in the Constitution. On Wednesday, Trump said he delivered a, quote, ultimatum to Tehran over its nuclear program amidst reports he'd approved U.S. war plans against Iran. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, said this week there is no proof Iran is building a nuclear weapon. One rights group found Israeli strikes on Iran have killed at least 639 people and wounded double that number. One of the victims was the Iranian poet Parnia Abbasi. She was killed alongside family members in Tehran days ahead of her 24th birthday. Amidst the ongoing assault and threats of escalation, many Iranians have been fleeing Iran. This is a dual Iranian-Australian citizen speaking from Iran's border with Armenia.
The worst thing in this world is war. It is because of the war that we live like this, a nomadic life. People are trying to leave the country through all available borders if possible.
Israeli authorities say at least 24 people have been killed in Iranian attacks on Israel. On Thursday, Israeli President Isaac Herzog decried an Iranian strike that damaged a hospital in Beersheba, accusing Tehran of war crimes. Over the past 20 months, Israel's decimated Gaza's health infrastructure, completely destroying or damaging 38 hospitals, as well as 81 major health centers and 164 other health facilities, including clinics and labs. In Gaza, nearly 100 Palestinians, including children, have been killed over the past day in Israeli attacks. Among those killed were more families who are seeking humanitarian aid and food amidst an ongoing hunger crisis across the besieged territory. This is a Palestinian mother whose child was killed in an Israeli strike on Gaza City.
I have 3 sons, 2 died and 1 remains. I don't want anything. I want to die with them, be buried with them. May God punish you, Netanyahu. May God punish you, Israel and America.
This comes as the United Nations has again blacklisted Israel for committing grave violations against Palestinian children. The UN report also says violence against children in war zones reached unprecedented levels last year, with the highest violations committed by the Israeli army in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, UNICEF warned Thursday malnutrition among children in Gaza is rising at an alarming rate. More than 5,000 children under the age of 5 were treated for acute malnutrition amidst Israel's near total blockade of aid. This is a Palestinian mother of 4.
You either come back carrying food for your children and they will be happy, or you come back in a shroud, or you go back upset without food and your children will cry. This is life. We are being slaughtered. We can't do it anymore. Open the aid institutions for people. Open them. Enough victims. Enough death. Enough. See? They're shooting randomly, and we're by the sea. When we go to get aid, our children start crying. They can't take it.
In a 6-3 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court Wednesday upheld Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth, paving the way for other bans on trans health care to remain in effect in 24 other states. The court's right-wing justices rejected arguments on behalf of Tennessee trans kids and their parents that the ban on those treatments discriminated on the basis of sex because they remain permitted for other medical treatments. In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor accused her conservative colleagues of, quote, contorting logic and precedent and abandoning transgender children and their families to political whims, unquote. Trans activists rallied at a Washington, D.C. church after the ruling.
They can say I'm a woman, but I live as a man. I love as a man.
Separately, on Wednesday, Trump's health department ordered the National Suicide Hotline for LGBTQ plus youth to shut down next month. In its announcement, HHS omitted reference to the transgender population using the term LGB plus youth services. One advocate called the move a potential death sentence for thousands of LGBTQ plus youth. We'll speak with Chase Strangio, the first openly trans attorney to argue before the Supreme Court on this and the Supreme Court decision. The Department of Homeland Security has issued new restrictions to limit inspections of immigration jails by Congress members. Under the new rules, Congress members are required to provide notice of a visit to any ICE jail at least 72 hours in advance, while giving ICE sole discretion to deny or cancel visits. This week, Illinois Congress members Delia Ramirez and Jesus Chuy Garcia were blocked from visiting an ICE facility in Broadview. And in New York, Congressmember Jerry Nadler was denied access to an ICE detention unit at 26 Federal Plaza in Manhattan, where advocates report dozens of immigrants arrested at court hearings are being detained in overcrowded conditions for several days at a time, many forced to sleep on the floor while waiting to be transferred. A California appeals court has allowed Trump to remain in control of National Guard troops deployed in Los Angeles as a lawsuit proceeds. As ICE raids continue in Los Angeles, the Dodgers baseball team blocked federal immigration agents from accessing their grounds during a game Thursday. Angelinos arrived to the stadium's entrance to protest ICE after they were cited trying to access the parking lots. This comes after the team's management was rebuffed on Saturday when they insisted on the Star Spangled Banner be performed in English. Singer Neza surprised everyone when she instead sang it in Spanish, adding afterwards, "That was my moment to stand for my people and let them know that I'm with them," she said. Nez's parents are immigrants from Colombia and the Dominican Republic. The Latinx community in L.A. is demanding the Dodgers do more to defend immigrant communities, a large portion of its fan base. Dodgers star Kiki Hernandez posted on social media, quote, "This is my second home, and I cannot stand to see our community being violated, profiled, abused, and ripped apart. All people deserve to be treated with respect, dignity, and human rights. Hashtag City of Immigrants." The Miami Herald reports the Trump administration detained at least 20 Haitian asylum seekers at the Guantanamo U.S. Naval Base in Cuba before deporting them to Haiti earlier this week. This came days after Trump officials had denied previous reports of plans to transfer thousands more immigrants to be detained at Guantanamo. The Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda have reached a provisional peace agreement aimed at ending the war in the eastern DRC and decades of conflict. Among other provisions, the draft deal mediated by the United States and Qatar would lead to the disarmament and integration of M23 fighters and other armed groups in the eastern DRC. Rwanda has been repeatedly accused of supporting M23, which has seized major portions of the eastern DRC, including the cities of Goma and Bukavu, killing thousands of people and displacing hundreds of thousands more since January. The deal, expected to be signed next week, would also allow Western countries to exploit the mineral-rich region with investments worth billions of dollars. Activists from around the world have returned home from Egypt after the global march to Gaza ended. The activists were prevented by authorities from reaching Egypt's Rafah border crossing, where they hoped to break the siege on Gaza. Participants were subjected to attacks, arrests, and deportations as they made their journey through Egypt and Libya. Members of the Samoud convoy, a North African humanitarian convoy, returned to Tunisia Thursday. This is Wael Naouar, one of the convoy's organizers.
"Our convoy was stopped by force of arms, not by force of regulations or the law. Today, we returned after being subjected to numerous violations and many restrictions. We didn't reach Rafah, and we didn't break the siege, but we felt that, emotionally and symbolically, we went far beyond Rafah. We reached the whole world."
Back in the United States, a federal judge has blocked the Environmental Protection Agency from terminating $600 million in environmental justice grants. Those funds, which came as part of the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, were designated to assist low-income communities of color that have suffered generations of environmental racism. In his ruling, Judge Adam Abelson cited the, quote, "lack of any reasoned decision-making or reasoned explanation," unquote. In labor news, a Safeway grocery store strike is spreading across Colorado, with 1,000 workers now on strike at 10 stores and distribution centers in 4 major cities across Colorado. Workers are denouncing cuts to health care and retirement benefits and demanding improved staffing in stores. Parent company Albertsons cleared almost $1 billion in profits last year, while the CEO, Vivek Sankaran, made over $15 million in salary and stocks last year. Meanwhile, some 45,000 Southern California grocery workers voted last week to authorize a strike at Ralph's, Albertsons, Vons, and Pavilion stores. And President Trump's wave of pardons and clemency since returning to office have allowed beneficiaries to evade over $1.3 billion in fines and restitution to victims. That's according to a report by Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee. Trump's pardon spree has offered the greatest financial relief to the, quote, "fraudsters, millionaire tax evaders, and other white-collar criminals," unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, is set to hold talks with France, Germany, and the United Kingdom today in Geneva as Israel's attacks on Iran enter a second week. A U.S.-based Iranian human rights group reports the Israeli attacks have killed at least 639 people. Israeli warplanes have repeatedly pummeled Tehran and other parts of Iran. Iran's responded by continuing to launch missile strikes into Israel. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians protested today in Iran against Israel. Meanwhile, President Trump continues to give mixed messages on whether the U.S. will join Israel's attack on Iran. On Wednesday, Trump told reporters, quote, "I may do it, I may not do it," unquote. On Thursday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt delivered a new statement from the president.
regarding the ongoing situation in Iran. I know there has been a lot of speculation amongst all of you in the media regarding the president's decision-making and whether or not the United States will be directly involved. In light of that news, I have a message directly from the president, and I quote, "Based on the fact that there's a substantial chance of negotiations that may or may not take place with Iran in the near future, I will make my decision whether or not to go within the next 2 weeks."
President Trump has repeatedly used that term 2 weeks when being questioned about decisions in this term and his first term as president. Levitt delivered the message shortly after President Trump met with his former advisor, Steve Bannon, who's publicly warned against war with Iran. Bannon recently said, quote, "We can't do this again. We'll tear the country apart. We can't have another Iraq," Bannon said. This comes as Trump's reportedly sideline National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard from key discussions on Iran. In March, Gabbard told lawmakers the intelligence community, quote, "continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon," unquote. But on Tuesday, Trump dismissed her statement, saying, "I don't care what she said." Earlier Thursday, an Iranian missile hit the main hospital in southern Israel in Beersheba. After the strike, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz threatened to assassinate Ayatollah Ali Khamenei Thursday, saying Iran's supreme leader, quote, "cannot continue to exist," unquote. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited the hospital and likened Iran's attack to the London Blitz. Netanyahu stunned many in Israel by saying, quote, "each of us bears a personal cost. My family has not been exempt. This is the second time my son Avner has canceled a wedding due to missile threats," unquote. We're joined now by William Hartung, senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His new piece for the National Interest is headlined, "Don't Get Dragged Into a War with Iran." Can you talk about what's going on right now, Bill? The whole question of whether the U.S. is going to use a bunker buster bomb that has to be delivered by a B-2 bomber,
Which
only the U.S. has.
I mean, this is a case of, you know, undue trust in technology. The U.S. is always getting in trouble when they didn't think there's this miracle solution. A lot of experts aren't sure this would even work, or if it did, it would take multiple bombings. And of course, Iran's not going to sit on its hands. They'll respond possibly by killing U.S. troops in the region. Then we'll have escalation from there. It's reminiscent of the beginning of the Iraq War when they said it's going to be a cakewalk. It's not going to cost anything. A couple $1 trillion, hundreds of thousands of casualties, many U.S. veterans coming home with PTSD, a regime that was sectarian, that paved the way for ISIS. It couldn't have gone worse. And so, you know, this is a different beginning, but the end is uncertain, and I don't think we want to go there, you know.
So can you talk about the GBU-57, the bunker buster bomb, and how is it that this discussion going on within the White House about the use of the bomb? And of course, the U.S. has gone back and forth, I should say President Trump has gone back and forth, whether he's fully involved with this war, at first saying they knew about it, but Israel was doing it, then saying we have total control of the skies over Tehran. Saying we, not Israel. And what exactly it would mean if the U.S. dropped this bomb and the fleet that the U.S. is moving in?
Yes. Well, the notion is, you know, it's heavy steel. It's more explosive power than any conventional bomb. But it only goes so deep. And they don't actually know how deep this facility is buried. And if it's going in a straight line and it's to one side, it's just not clear that it's going to work. And of course, if it does, Iran is going to rebuild. They're going to go straight for a nuclear weapon. They're not going to trust negotiations anymore. So apparently the 2 weeks is partly because Trump's getting conflicting reports from his own people about this. Now, if he had actual independent military folks like Mark Milley in the first term, I think we'd be less likely to go in. But they made sure to have loyalists. I mean, Pete Hegseth is not a profile in courage. He's not going to stand up to Trump on this. He may not even know the consequences. So a lot of the press coverage is about this bomb, not about the consequences of an act of war.
Right, about using it. In your recent piece, you wrote Israeli officials suggested their attacks may result in regime change in Iran, despite the devastating, destabilizing impact such efforts in the region would have. Can you talk about the significance of Israel putting forward and then Trump going back and forth on whether or not Ali Khamenei will be targeted?
Yeah, I think my colleague Trita Parsi put it well. There's been no example of regime change in the region that has come out with a better result. They don't know what kind of regime will come in. Could be to the right of the current one. Could just be chaos that would fuel terrorism, who knows what else. So, you know, they're just taking, they're winging it. They have no idea what they're getting into. And I think Trump, he doesn't want to seem like Netanyahu was pulling him by the nose. So when he gets out in front of Trump, Trump then says, oh, that was my idea. But it's almost as if Benjamin Netanyahu is running U.S. foreign policy and Trump is kind of following along.
I mean, you have Netanyahu back in 2002 saying Iran is imminently going to have a nuclear bomb. That was more than two decades ago.
Exactly. That's just a cover for wanting to take out the regime. And he's come, he spoke to the U.S. Congress. He's made presentations all over the world. And his intelligence has been proven wrong over and over and over. And when we had the Iran deal, you had European allies, you had China, you had Russia. There hadn't been a deal like that where all these countries were on the same page in living memory. And it was working. And Trump trashed it and now has to start over, you know.
So talk about the War Powers Act. The Virginia Senator, Kane, has said that, has just put forward a bill around saying it must be, Congress must vote on this. Where is Schumer? Where is Jeffries on this? The Democratic House and Senate leaders.
Well, a lot of the so-called leaders are not leading. I mean, when is the moment that you shouldn't step forward if we're possibly going to get into another disastrous war? But I think they're concerned about being viewed as critical of Israel. They don't want to go out on a limb. So you've got a progressive group that's saying, you know, this has to be authorized by Congress. You've got Republicans who are doubtful but don't want to stand up to Trump because they don't want to lose their jobs. Risk your job. I mean, this is a huge thing. You know, don't just sort of be a time server.
So according to a report from IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, released in May, Iran has accumulated roughly 120 kilograms of uranium enriched to 60%, which is 30% away from weapons grade level of 90%. You have Rafael Grossi, the head of the IAEA, saying this week that they do not have evidence that Iran is has the system for a nuclear bomb.
Yes, well, a lot of the discussion points out, they don't talk about it. When you've got the uranium, you have to build the weapon, you have to make it work on a missile. It's not you get the uranium, you have a weapon overnight. So there's time to deal with that should they go forward through negotiations. And we had a deal that was working, which Trump threw aside in his first term.
Talk about the foreign minister of Iran, Araghchi, in Geneva right now, speaking with his counterparts from Britain, France, the EU.
Well, I don't think U.S. allies in Europe want to go along with this. And I think he's looking for some, you know, leverage over Trump. And, of course, Trump is very hard to read. But even his own base, majority of Trump supporters, don't want to go to war. You've got people like Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, saying it would be a disaster. But ultimately, it comes down to Trump. He's unpredictable. He's transactional. He'll calculate what he thinks it will mean for him.
And what impact does protests have around the country as we wrap up?
Well, I think taking a stand is infectious. So many institutions were caving to Trump. And the more people stand up, 2,000 demonstrations around the country, the more the folks sitting on the fence, the millions of people who they're against Trump, but they don't know what to do, the more of us that get involved, the better chance we have of turning this thing around. So we should not let them discourage us. We need to build power to push back against all these horrible things.
Finally, if the U.S. were to bomb the nuclear site, that it would require the bunker buster bomb to hit below ground, underground, are we talking about nuclear fallout here?
I think there would certainly be radiation that would, of course, affect the Iranian people. They've already had many civilian deaths. It's not this kind of precise thing that's only hitting military targets. And that, too, has to affect Iran's view of this. I mean, they were shortly away from another negotiation. Now their country's being devastated. So can they trust us, you know?
Bill Hartung is Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His new piece for the National Interest is headlined, "Don't Get Dragged into a War with Iran." Go to democracynow.org. We'll provide the link. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a major Supreme Court ruling. Stay with us.
Said you're gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river. Shoot me down, put my body in the river. And the whole world sings, sing it like a song. The whole world sings like there's nothing going wrong. He shot her down, he put her body in the river. He covered her up, but I went to get her and I said, my girl, what happened to you now? I said, my girl, we gotta stop it somehow. Gonna do for a world that's so sick and sad. And tell me what's a man with a rifle in his hand gonna do for a world that's all gone mad. He's gonna
Body Electric by Linda Segarra of Hooray for the Riffraff, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In a 6-3 decision Wednesday, the Supreme Court upheld Tennessee's ban on puberty blockers and hormone therapy for transgender youth, paving the way for other bans on trans health care to remain in effect in 24 other states. According to the ACLU, over 100,000 transgender people under the age of 18 now live in a state with a ban on their health care. The court's right-wing justices rejected arguments on behalf of Tennessee trans kids and their parents, which claimed the ban on those treatments discriminated on the basis of sex because they remained permitted for other medical treatments for non-trans youth. In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor accused her conservative colleagues of, quote, contorting logic and precedent and abandoning transgender children and their families to political whims, unquote. Trans activists rallied at a Washington, D.C. church after the ruling.
They can say I'm a woman, but I live as a man. I love as a man.
We're joined now in studio by Chase Strangio, the ACLU attorney who argued the case known as United States versus Scrimeti before the Supreme Court in December. Chase made history by becoming the first openly trans attorney to argue at the high court, a story captured in the new documentary Heightened Scrutiny. Chase, welcome back to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for being with us. Explain what happened. Explain the decision of the Supreme Court this week.
Thanks, Amy. So in the decision, the Supreme Court, in essence, said that Tennessee's law, which bans puberty blockers and hormone therapy when they are prescribed in a way that is inconsistent with an adolescent sex, that's what the statute says, is not discriminatory. It doesn't discriminate based on sex or transgender status, and therefore the government of Tennessee has wide latitude to regulate in this area. Now, I think Justice Sotomayor got it exactly right in her dissent that they had to contort logic and precedent in order to reach the conclusion that a law that says you can do something consistent with your sex, but you can't do something inconsistent with your sex is not a form of sex discrimination. But ultimately, the 6-3 conservative majority said that it was not discriminatory, as you noted, paving the way for the 24 laws that ban this care for adolescents in the United States to remain in effect.
Tell us the story of the family that's at the core of this case.
Yeah, so one of the most heartbreaking things about this moment is just thinking about the families and the parents, and as a parent, what it means to watch your child suffer. So we represent three families. LW is one of the adolescents and her parents who we sued Tennessee on behalf of.
I'm going to interrupt for one sec just to read about this case, an excerpt from a New York Times opinion piece written by Samantha Williams, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit challenging Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care. Her daughter has only been identified by the initials LW. The op-ed is titled, "My daughter was at the center of the Supreme Court case on trans care. Our hearts are broken." She writes, "My daughter LW came out as transgender late in 2020. She was just shy of 13. 4.5 years later, she's thriving, healthy, and happy after pursuing evidence-based gender-affirming care. I've devoted myself to finding our daughter consistent care in one state after another. The nightmare of our disrupted life pales in comparison with the nightmare of losing access to the health care that's allowed our daughter to thrive. If one thing gives me hope, it's my daughter. Even after all the emotions of today, LW has been texting me all day about her plans for how to continue the fight for young people like her." Tell us more, Chase.
Yeah, so I mean, I think Samantha hits it on the head. Is these are parents who watched their children suffer tremendously for many years, looking for a solution, doing their own research, talking to medical experts. And then what they found was that their children who were experiencing this intense distress began to thrive when they had access to gender-affirming medical care like hormones and puberty blockers. And these are not rushed decisions. These are careful decisions that parents are making with their children and their doctors. And what Tennessee did, what these other governments have done, is come in and displace the judgment of parents and adolescents and doctors and substituted their own ideological preferences for how people live and identify.
Clearly a blow to the transgender community. It was a 6-3 ruling. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the majority, opening, quote, saying, "This case carries with it the weight of fierce scientific and policy debates about the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field. The voices in these debates raise sincere concerns. The implications for all are profound. The Equal Protection Clause does not resolve these disagreements." And again, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the high court, quote, "abandons transgender children and their families to political whims, as well as undermines the Constitution," saying the decision causes, quote, "irrevocable damage to the Equal Protection Clause and invites legislatures to engage in discrimination by hiding blatant sex classifications in plain sight. In sadness, I dissent," Justice Sotomayor said.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chief Justice Roberts' language there is just wrong in so many different ways. First, the medical debate that he is referencing was not a debate that the district court found in the court's factual findings. It was a Trump-appointed district court judge who looked at the evidence and concluded that the Tennessee's arguments in support of their ban just did not hold up to scrutiny. But even more importantly, the question of whether or not the law discriminates based on sex on its face does not consider that medical debate. Looking at the plain language of the statute, it says you can do something consistent with your sex, you can't do something inconsistent with your sex. If the court starts importing their own ideas about what's a good or bad sex-based distinction, we're back to 50 years ago when they're allowing all sorts of discriminatory laws to stand.
What's Bostock and explain how it's affected by this?
Yeah, so as much as this is a devastating decision, I think it's important to make sure people understand that it does not do some of the damage that people feared. So Bostock is a 2020 Supreme Court decision in which the court held that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits sex discrimination in employment, also prohibits discrimination against LGBTQ people. And that decision was a 6-3 decision from Justice Gorsuch. And in the Scrimeti case, the court explicitly leaves intact that decision. And the court says that they are declining to address whether that decision applies outside the context of Title VII. And that's important because it means that litigation over things like discrimination in school, other forms of discrimination by the government, remain open to fight another day.
Can you talk about the other cases in the last few weeks that have gone actually both ways? But before you do, I mean, the irony of conservative justices and conservative states or states run by Republicans that have always insisted, for example, when it comes to abortion, a kid has to tell their parents when it comes to parental consent, etc. You have LW's parents with a doctor in a room with LW, they're all hashing this out.
Yes, you have this aligned judgment of parents, adolescents, and doctors, and the government is coming in and imposing their preference. The same governments that in every other context are spouting how important parental rights are, parental right to not mask your child, parental rights to not have your child learn about LGBT people in school or the history of racism in the United States. So this is hypocrisy at its most clear point, and I think we should really be watching for when the Supreme Court upholds the parental rights of parents to, for example, stop their children from accessing contraception or abortion. But when it's the parents who love and support their trans children, all of a sudden their parental rights don't matter.
Separately, on Wednesday, Trump's health department ordered the National Suicide Hotline for LGBTQ plus youth to shut down. In its announcement, HHS omitted reference to the transgender population, using the term LGB plus youth services. One advocate called the move a potential death sentence for thousands of LGBTQ plus youth. It reminded me of erasing from the federal website around Stonewall, which is a federal monument now, that was led by trans women that launched the modern day LGBTQ movement, taking out the T there. What about here? And what about the hotline itself, what it means?
Yeah, I mean, this is a population that has a unique vulnerability to suicidality. This service was vital for LGBTQ young people. And what the administration is doing is making abundantly clear that their systematic attacks on the LGBTQ community are not about protecting anyone. They are about harming young people, taking away vital services. If you put this in conversation with the bans on trans people serving in the military, the bans on people going to the bathroom, participating in sports, and now the decision in Scrimeti, you have a country that is prepared to not only fully attack us across all areas of life, but take away our lifelines, quite literally.
Can you talk about Judge Young and the decision that came out of Boston?
Yeah, so this is a decision in a challenge to the government's attempts to cut off NIH grants anytime they reference LGBT people or people of color. And Judge Young issued an injunction, in essence, forcing the government to reissue those grants, and said from the bench that in his 40 years on the bench, he has not seen such rank discrimination on the basis of race, and that this is plain as plain can be, that this government is invested in discriminating against people of color and LGBT people, and ordered them to restart those vital grants. Because not only are we living in a moment that is anti-people of color, anti-LGBT people from this administration, but they are also anti-science and cutting off vital research avenues that judges thankfully are stepping in and trying to restore as much as possible.
And Young was a Reagan-appointed judge. He said he's never seen discrimination like this.
Yes, and there's another Reagan-appointed judge in the District of D.C. that ordered the administration to stop banning gender-affirming medical care for trans people in the Bureau of Prisons. This is an administration that is attacking us in every aspect of life, and judge after judge across the political spectrum, going back to Reagan-appointed judges, are stepping in and saying absolutely not.
Can you respond to the New York Times piece that just came out, major hit piece against you, Chase, that was written by Nicholas Confessori? Its headline, How the Transgender Rights Movement Bet on the Supreme Court and Lost. Confessori writes, quote, Strangio and other advocates for trans rights have cast Scrimeti as the case they had to bring, and may also have set back their movement back a generation.
Well, I think that's just absolutely wrong. This is a fight that extends back 100 years, and we will keep fighting for 100 more years. The piece absolutely gets it wrong in terms of what this decision does and doesn't do. It's a narrow decision. It leaves open many other avenues to fight back against discrimination on behalf of trans people. But for everyone who is saying that the movement got ahead of public opinion, that litigators got ahead of public opinion, the very purpose of the Equal Protection Clause, the very purpose of the Reconstruction Amendments is to be a check on majoritarian discrimination. If the public's opinion is that you deserve to have your constitutional right infringed, then the very purpose of the Constitution is to step in. That is the role of the federal courts, and that is the role of civil rights advocates, and we will keep fighting.
The hit piece comes at the same time as a major documentary on you, Chase. The documentary premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. It was also at DC Docs, the new film festival in Washington, D.C. It's called Heightened Scrutiny. It shows you addressing trans community members and supporters outside the Supreme Court after you made history as the first openly trans lawyer to deliver oral arguments in front of the court. The hearing back in December was for this case.
We are the defiance of everything. Okay. Peppermint loves to give me advice about how to project. That's all I'm going to work on. We are collectively a refutation of everything they say about us. And our fight for justice did not begin today. It will not end in June, whatever the court decides. We are in this together. We are in it together. Our power only grows. I love being trans. I love being with you, and we are going to take care of each other. Thank you for being here. I felt it inside.
That's Chase Strangio, a clip from the new film Heightened Scrutiny that will also premiere in Los Angeles next week at the Hammer Museum. Talk about what you're hoping to accomplish with this film.
Well, I think one of the really important things about this film is that it offers a critique of mainstream media coverage of transgender people and our healthcare, in addition to the verite parts that are me preparing for oral argument. And one of the things the film really highlights is the ways in which the media's outsized fixation on transgender people contributes to anti-trans policymaking. Media Matters reported that in the last 4 months, Fox News ran 400 segments on transgender athletes. If you think about the fact that we are less than 1% of the population, transgender athletes must be 1/100th of a percent of the population, and yet this outsized fixation with us and our lives is what is driving so much of the anti-trans policies that we're seeing. And so it's so important that we challenge those narratives, that we make people aware of the misinformation that they are receiving, because if we don't, we're going to continue to see these attacks.
And finally, the decision also this week around passports.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to know that we're still getting good decisions in the lower courts. The judge said that, in essence, Trump's policy of forcing people to have passports listing their sex assigned at birth is blocked, not just for our six named plaintiffs, but for everyone across the country. People can reapply for both binary passports and X passports under the policy.
Explain what you mean. Either your male, female doesn't have to match
your sex assigned at birth. So if
You can do X.
Or you can do X. And that was the policy on January 19th. And in essence, the court says we're back to January 19th with respect to the policy. And transgender people, non-binary people, and intersex people can apply for the M, F, and X passports that match who they are, not what their sex was at conception, which is the Trump administration's preference.
Chase Strangio, thanks so much for being with us. Co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union LGBTQ and HIV Project. In December, he became the first openly trans lawyer to argue in front of the Supreme Court when he presented oral arguments in the United States v. Scrimeti. Coming up, we speak to a Columbia University graduate who was just denied entry back into the United States because of his writing about pro-Palestine protests on campus. The authorities at the airport were very explicit about why they were deporting him. Stay with us.
And you can only view with what you got. You don't have to pretend that you gotta know more. cause you are young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. Cause you woke up feeling like this. You woke up knowing that you be you for the rest of your, for the rest of your life, for the rest of your life. Cause you are young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. And we are young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud.
Young, Latin and proud by Lalo Negro, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman. An Australian writer was recently detained for some 15 hours, then deported from a U.S. airport for his writings about pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University. Alistair Kitchen was detained by border agents after he'd flown from Melbourne, Australia, to Los Angeles. He reports a border agent told him, quote, "Look, we both know why you're here." When Kitchen said he didn't know why, the agent reportedly said, quote, "It's because of what you wrote online about the protests at Columbia University." Alistair had graduated from a master's program at Columbia last year when the protests against Israel's war on Gaza began. He'd written about the student encampments on his Substack page. PEN America said Kitchen's detention and deportation was, quote, "gravely concerning." Jonathan Friedman of PEN America said, quote, "Kitchen's account fits a disturbing pattern in which border agents appear to be screening visitors to the U.S. for their viewpoints. That is anti-democratic and it must be halted," unquote. We go now to Australia, where we're joined by Alistair Kitchen. The New Yorker magazine recently published his account of what happened in a piece headlined, "How My Reporting on the Columbia Protests Led to My Deportation." Alistair, thanks so much for staying up late to talk to us. Tell us the day this all happened, where you were, and just what took place.
Well, I had flown 15 hours all the way to LAX, and frankly, I was prepared for something to go wrong. There's been plenty of media here in Australia about tourists getting detained at US airports for all range of reasons. I've written about the protests and I've written critically about the Trump administration. So I went ahead and scrubbed my phone, scrubbed my social media feed. But just as I got to get into the passport queue for my ESTA, my visa waiver, I was detained and interrogated and told that the reason was, as you say, what I had written online.
So explain what happened. You come off your plane and were people waiting for you there?
Yeah, this is crucial. They were waiting for me when I got off the plane. I didn't even make it into the queue for passport processing. Instead, the intercom went over the loudspeaker and my name was called. I was asked to meet an officer at the back of the room. And he immediately took me away, immediately asked for my phone, and then immediately asked for the passcode of that phone. I said I'd rather not hand over my passcode. He said, "That's fine. We will immediately deny you entry and deport you." And that's when I made the wrong choice to hand over the passcode to my phone, believing wrongly and hoping wrongly that they would see that I'm a writer, that I was writing about the protests in the capacity as a journalist, and that I certainly pose no threat to the country, and that I have many loved ones in the U.S.
Well, describe the scene where you were brought to. Who else was there, both detainees like you, how long they'd been there? And then, I mean, the questioning took place over hours, is that right?
Yeah, right. I was first taken to this back room. I was sat down. The questioning began immediately with this opening gambit about Israel and Palestine. I was asked questions about what my thoughts were on the conflict, how I would solve it. Do I know any Jews? Do I know any Muslims? I was asked to hand over the names of students, student groups I was involved with, WhatsApp groups with other protesters, all of which I refused to do. And then after some time, after he was satisfied, he then began the process of downloading the contents of my phone. He went away, disappeared for some time, came back out, and that was when I really knew I was in trouble, because he said to me, "Mr. Kitchen, we've found evidence on your phone of prior drug use. On your ESTA visa waiver form, you represented to us that you had not consumed drugs before. That misrepresentation is grounds for denial of entry and deportation." That was maybe 1 to 2 hours in of a 12-hour process. I was interviewed at that point. I was interviewed again maybe 6 hours later in a Groundhog Day moment where all of the same questions were asked. And in the meantime, I was held in a detention room with, there were 5 women in there. I was the only man when I arrived.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes,
on the issue of drugs? In New York State, you can consume marijuana. Can you explain what they were talking about?
Yeah, so I previously, they identified that I had consumed, and I admitted to having bought marijuana in New York State. This is very important for any international listeners of yours. If you buy marijuana in California, in New York, you are doing so legally by state law, but you're doing so illegally by federal law. And therefore, in the eyes of Customs and Border Protection, you are breaking the law and you're misrepresenting your behavior when you said that you haven't consumed illicit drugs.
So if you can respond to what the U.S. government is now saying to various media outlets, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said using the ESTA is a privilege and a right, and only those who respect our laws and follow the proper procedures will be welcomed. And they deny that DHS said that they denied that they were targeting you for your political beliefs. That seems to run counter to what you were told when you were being interrogated. And tell us how much into the conversation, into the interrogation you were questioned, and what the agent said to you about your political writing.
Yeah, it's contrary explicitly to what they told me as soon as I arrived. And to this extent, I'm lucky. I'm lucky that they were so forthcoming in the moment and so brazen as to say, look, we both know why you're here. It's because of what you've written online. I'm going to interrogate you now about what you've written online. Now, the DHS now wants to come out and deny that. Of course they do. And of course, they want to focus on the drug case as grounds for deportation. I'm not disputing that at all. Of course, what I'm here to say is that Customs and Border Protection are using the immense power and discretion that they have to search and then to deny entry under politically motivated grounds and politically motivated reasons. They're doing so clearly and explicitly in their own words, because they disagree with some people's speech, they didn't like what I said, so they went looking for a reason to deport me.
So your final takeaway from this detention and deportation, what you felt you would warn people about?
Yeah, the first is, this might sound severe, but if you don't have a great reason to go to the United States and you're a tourist, this might not be the time. The second is that if you have anything sensitive on your phone, do not take that phone. Take a burner phone, buy it early, populate it with some content so that it doesn't look suspicious. And the third thing is, if all that fails and you end up in the position that I was in, and you were offered, after getting off a 15-hour flight, a choice between deportation and having your phone searched and downloaded, My view is accept immediate deportation, spend the 12 hours in detention, and go home, because by the time they're ready to look through your phone, they're never going to let you in anyway.
Alistair Kitchen, I thank you for being with us. Australian writer deported last week, wrote about his experience for The New Yorker in a piece headlined, How My Reporting on the Columbia Protests Led to My Deportation. We will link to it at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to turn right now to ranked choice voting. As New Yorkers head to the polls in the primaries for upcoming local elections Tuesday, voters will have the chance to vote for not one, but up to five of their preferred candidates for mayor and other races. Early voting, actually, is taking place now through Sunday. This is a brief explainer from the New York Board of Elections.
There's a new way for New Yorkers to have their say in city elections. A way that gives voters more choices and can lead to more diverse winners. It's called ranked choice voting. 74% of New York voters chose to use it in primary and special elections for city offices, mayor, public advocate, comptroller, borough president, and city council.
This is a relatively new system for New Yorkers. It was introduced following a referendum in 2019. It's also in use in Maine and Alaska, is gaining interest across the country. Early voting underway now through the weekend ahead of Tuesday's primary. I spoke to John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, closely following New York City's mayor election, began by asking him how ranked choice voting works and how it came to New York.
Sure. So ranked choice voting was first implemented in San Francisco in 2004, and it's now used in about 40 cities and towns across the United States, including in Oakland, Boulder, Colorado, Minneapolis, Burlington, Vermont, Tacoma Park, Maryland, and other places. And it's also used statewide in Maine and Alaska. And like that announcement was saying, we had a voter referendum in New York that approved it in 2019, and we first implemented it in 2021 in our last mayoral cycle here in New York.
And what's the problem it's correcting?
Well, the problem it's correcting in our kind of winner-take-all electoral system is that if you vote for a lower-performing candidate in a race where there's a lot of candidates, your vote can be wasted or spoiled. And an example I think many people could relate to in your audience is in Florida 2000, when Ralph Nader got 97,000 votes and Al Gore ultimately lost the presidency by 537 votes. If there had been ranked choice voting, Green Party supporters who might have wanted to keep, you know, the Republican from getting the White House, they could have made Al Gore their second choice.
They could still do Ralph Nader first,
yes,
but they would make Al Gore second.
Yeah, and so all those debates about, you know, spoilers and wasted votes that we get every 4 years in presidential politics, if we had ranked choice voting, people could vote. But it allows you to both vote for who you most want, but then to also, make a second choice selection for other candidates that you also like. And it prevents the dynamic, if you vote for a low performing candidate, that someone else that you would least want to win ends up prevailing. So it gives voters more choices and more power in determining the ultimate winner of an election.
And so when was it first instituted here in New York? The election is Tuesday.
Yeah, it was first instituted in our city elections in 2021. Under our rules here in New York, you can vote in order of preference for as many as five candidates. So you can, it's really changed the dynamic of the election here.
So John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent. You can see the full interview online. Early voting goes through Sunday in the New York City primary for mayor. Primary day is Tuesday. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. You can find out more at democracynow.org/jobs.
Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamat, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell.